And let's take a look at the international scene. As you know, tremendous conflict going on between India and Pakistan, with so many other things happening, perhaps really underreported. India, it is being reported, pressing attacks on Muslim guerrillas in a drive on the last day, say, Kashmir peak they hold. Wall Street Journal reporting the battle, the fiercest in 7 weeks of fighting, has killed at least 65. New Delhi says at least 800 infiltrators remain. Now, all of this, as Pakistan's prime minister cut short a China visit and his Indian counterpart held closed-door talks with aides, amid media speculation, at least, according to the Wall Street Journal, that a deal may be near on ending the fighting in Kashmir. Well, let's talk about that. We are joined now by Imran Anwar, founder of Imran Net Services in New York, pioneer of the internet email in Pakistan, and of course a well-known media expert on India, Pakistan, and Southeast Asia. Hi, Imran.
Hello, George, and good morning to you.
And bring us up to date, if you would. That's kind of the media speculation, and that's how it's going in the media. That's what the press is reporting. But what is happening as you see it?
Basically, I'm unhappy to report, I guess, that things haven't gotten any better in the last week since you and I spoke. Now, the fact that conversations are taking place is a good sign, but let's not forget that conversations have been taking place between both sides and between other parties, United States and China and other interested parties, for more than 50 years now. So, yes, it's a good sign in terms of defusing the current tensions and the situation, but in terms of a permanent, real solution to the problem, we're nowhere closer to that right now, and that is my biggest concern.
Well, of course, the solution is, you know, the two sides are obviously 180 degrees apart, because I would assume the solution from India's standpoint is the status quo, at least, which means a division of the disputed area of Kashmir, roughly as it stands, about 60% Indian and about 60% Pakistani controlled, I'll say. The Pakistani side would probably say, let's have a vote and let the Muslim majority decide what it wants to do, and it would probably vote for some form of autonomy or separate state. So, and I suspect that that would not sit well with India. So they are, am I correct, about 180 degrees apart still?
Absolutely. George, the 180 would really apply if India continues to insist, as it does, that Kashmir is an integral part of India, and if Pakistan insisted that Kashmir is an integral part of Pakistan. The fact of the matter is that India has steadfastly refused to accept United Nations resolutions that were passed, specifically saying that these people, the people of Kashmir, had not had the right, their right had been taken away by the desires and the wish of one man who said, I would rather go and join India. When the United Nations resolutions were passed, it was very clearly stated that these people would have the right to determine their own fate, whether they wanted to join India or Pakistan. Now, quite clearly, India is certain that it would lose such a plebiscite or an election if it took place. Pakistan is about 85-90% sure that these people would join Pakistan. Hence, what Pakistan continues to insist is not that Kashmir belongs to them, but that they are speaking to the world on behalf of the Kashmiris so that they can have their right to self-determination. So yes, they are opposing views, but it's not exactly two parties saying the exact thing, just, you know, opposed to each other.
No, I understand that. I mean, believe me, I never believe that, you know, you always hear the cliche, there are two sides to every story, and the implication of that somehow has grown to mean two equal sides. I don't say that both sides have equal truth on their side here, although I don't pretend to know where the absolute truth lies either in this dispute, because there are some things that confuse me. For example, why does the world and the United Nations seem to feel that they and seem to be leaning in the direction of supporting India in this instance, and why did the Kashmir population not uprise more violently when their leader chose to go with India? And I should ask also, was he an elected official who represented the will of the people? Potentially.
Three very good questions, George, and I'll try to answer them one by one. The United Nations, and most of the United States, is choosing to side, not with India so much as to to side with the status quo because that's pragmatism. Nobody wants to be rocking the boat. The United States realizes that the Soviet Union is sort of in a corner right now, and this is a good time for the United States to develop a long-term relationship with India. China, even though it's a, you know, it's a business and trading partner, is still not a reliable ally in any way of the United States. So India, the United States has a great incentive to bring India, so to speak, into its camp. They've done it and tried it in the past before. It hasn't worked, but it's always worth another try as far as politicians and State Department officials are concerned. Now, if that happens at the cost of justice for the Kashmiri people, you know, we have seen worse things happen in the world. And not that the United States is saying, damn those Kashmiris. What they're saying is we'll ignore that problem for now because it's more important to develop a relationship. The United Nations had resolutions. These resolutions have been in existence for decades now, and nothing was done upon them. We are now living in a world where no sooner does the ink dry on a United Nations resolution when bombing begins in Iraq, for example. So the problem I see with that is that countries like Pakistan, people like the Kashmiris, and even groups of the world's population, like the Muslims, for example, could begin to see that there's this little unfairness here. So the United States should keep its own best interests at heart. I see that as the right way to do politics. That's the right way to live in today's world. That's what they need to do. They have to develop a relationship with India. They have to make sure that they don't push India into the Russian camp, which is not that strong a camp anyway these days. So this actually may be a good time to put their foot down. And because of how successful they have been in Kosovo, this would have been a good time to solve that problem and say, a United Nations resolution exists. India, you do the right thing. Let this plebiscite take place. Let the people decide. And in exchange, we will make you our favorite trading partner, etc., etc. This could be the ultimate time to solve a problem that has gone on for 50 years, by the year 2000, for example. Answer to the second question. The military presence of India in occupied Kashmir is very strong, and the brutalities that they have and the atrocities they have committed are well documented. As a matter of fact, the United Nations and other observers are not even permitted to go into that region because of the fact that it is because of military and brute force that that population is kept in check. Thirdly, it was a Muslim state, a state full of Muslim people, but the ruler was a Maharaja. A Raja was not an elected ruler, so it was like a dictator, I would almost say, who chose to side with India at that time. Hence, it was not an elected process that took place.
Now, a couple of things. First of all, the U.S. is often in conflict with the United Nations. In fact, I think it generally behooves many countries in the United Nations to take some point of opposition to the United States. It's almost the politically correct thing to do. It's hard to believe that the UN would side with the U.S. because we're a big, powerful country, and those third world nations want to smooth it. So there must be some other dynamic here if the UN is so quiet.
The UN is quiet, basically, George, because remember the UN. What you used to say about the UN countries being somewhat opposed to the U.S. influence, etc. That held very true. As far as 5 or 10 years ago, and this applied to the fact that there were resolutions in place condemning Israeli policies and calling Zionism as racism, for example. Since the last 5 or so years, one, because of the failure of the Soviet system as a balancing force, secondly, the U.S.'s strong military and political dominance in world affairs, led to the fact that the UN, in many people's eyes, has almost become subservient to US policy. And that we saw in Iraq, in the Middle East, for example. We have seen even in things like Kosovo, if it was not with the NATO presence in that too, with a lot of United States influence, things would not get solved. And I'm saying that was a good thing that happened. So the UN is being used more than is the driver in these cases, I would beg to say.
Maybe we should never pay them then. That's the first. When we were paying them all the time, when we were paying them regularly, they were killing us. Let me ask you about something else. You say two things, Imran, and I have to represent our listeners on these issues because I can hear them asking these questions. You say that The atrocities are well documented in Kashmir, the Indian atrocities against the Kashmiri. On the other hand, you say that it's a closed system. No one's allowed in, not UN observers, not no international observers. How can it be well documented?
Journalists, photographers, independent watchers, people who belong to the human rights watchers, etc. Remember, I mean, China is as close to system as it can get. And yet we have images from China, we have facts from China, we know who's in jail, we know when somebody is beaten up in a Chinese prison, for example. So, yes, it's a closed system, but the whole world is watching, and the whole world is connected.
Now, and again, that confuses me, because generally you hear such tremendous outcries, particularly when a large nation is involved and the U.S. is backing it and so on and so forth. The international community is somehow, to me, and I'm not questioning the reality of what you're saying, I'm just saying that I'm baffled by what is the relative quiet of the international community. But let me ask you about where we're at right now. As we talked about this in the past, Muslim guerrillas held positions in the peaks in Kashmir in these mountains. They were very difficult, fortified positions. India attacking from their side of Kashmir, which would be the west side, I guess, of these peaks. The east side. And I was getting ahead of myself. The west side would be the Pakistani side. There's been talk they might come around the back. They didn't do that. They have been going head on, and it's been bloody battles. One general there talked about some of the more notorious battles to take mountains and hills in World War II, to make the comparison. The point is, though, that latest reports indicate that this fierce battle I mentioned, the fiercest in 7 weeks of fighting, killing a lot of folks there on both sides, but they say that it's the last piece. It looks like maybe they're starting to gain the ground. Now, the question is, what would an Indian victory over this effort by Muslim rebels or Muslim guerrillas, what does that mean to what is going on there and to the status of the situation?
Basically, George, I have been on the phone myself, and I hear conflicting reports on both sides, obviously. Much like the parallel that was drawn to World War II, there are two other parallels that can be drawn. One, propaganda is still an important tool. So no matter how many casualties you have, you will say, we lost 30 men, but the opposite side lost 700.
Right, right. No, I only meant that they were saying that it was bloody fighting. Whatever the losses on either side, I suspect that's true.
What I'm saying is that the funny thing with propaganda is that you will even be contradicting yourself. So one day you will say, there's a total of 700 insurgents left alive. The next day you will say, or a week later you will say, we have already killed 700,
mm-hmm.
but there are a few hundred more left. So that means whatever you said a week ago was false.
Right.
So that's the other parallel I wanted to draw to World War II. The more dangerous and the more scary parallel I would like to draw is World War II was a world war, and it started with local small countries being invaded or being controlled by one local power. The whole world was drawn in, and what took to bring it to a halt was a nuclear weapon killing millions of people. Those same parallels can be drawn here too. I don't want to even think about the whole world becoming involved, but look at the implications. Pakistan and India are surrounded by China and the Soviet Union, for example, and by Iran. The Iranians are Shiite Muslims who generally oppose Sunni Muslims, but when it becomes a war of this sort, you can be sure that they will fall in the Muslim camp, for example. The Soviets have seen their influence sort of go away in the whole world, and also the risk of having a war happening with nuclear potential at their borders is going to be very disturbing for them. Same for China. So there is the great risk of military intervention by other countries here. The U.S. may be making statements, we should believe in what happened in 1972, we should go back to the line of control, without even singly, even one time mentioning what the root problem is, what the root cause of the problem is, and what the U.N. resolutions on that issue are. It's just being swept under the rug. What I see the risk of that is that India could effectively close the conflict very quickly, the current conflict issue, by going over to line of control with all its military power, or trying to even open up a border with Pakistan with a little war on one of the other fronts, because Pakistan is a smaller country. However, if that happens, the Indians are not stupid. The Indian government knows that this is an easy way to solve the problem right now, but they also realize that a smaller country like Pakistan, if it is backed into a corner like that, and it has nuclear capability, it could potentially use that. Now, I'm not saying the Pakistanis would like to use it first, or the Indians would like to use nuclear weapons first, but when you are in a situation like that, especially when honor, sovereignty, and even religious hatred might be at play, you are more likely to press the nuclear button than, say, the deliberate and very well-planned and thought-out actions that the United States may have done in dropping nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, well, of course, that to me is an anomaly in history. Nobody understood the implications of nuclear war in those days, and we had been fighting for many years against an extremely brutal enemy. But the Cold War tells us what kind of reality we faced in terms of anybody effectively thinking they could use nuclear weapons in better part of 50 years. Two giant powers, heavily armed, knew better, even though they faced off in one form or another with conventional armies several times. I suspect that you'd have to be insane in India or Pakistan to think that using the nuclear option, I don't want to get cavalier about this, but I suspect that to think you could use the nuclear option without bringing the world down on you and destroying yourself in the process, you'd have to be insane to think that. And I don't think the leaders of either of those countries are insane. They may be angry, but they're not insane.
As a matter of fact, I agree with you, George, but there comes a stage, especially in countries like Pakistan and India, which have a history of fighting battles in the name of religion or fighting battles in the name of culture or being just so opposite each other in terms of black and white, that honor and even going down fighting or going down, you know, in flames might be the right thing to do, because it might assure you a place in heaven or whatever else you believe in.
Certainly in heaven. Let me ask you this question. We're almost out of time. They are talking, as I said, that in the press at least, that perhaps some deal might be struck. It raises many questions we can't answer here because of time, like how can they strike a deal, the Pakistanis, if in fact they're not really supposed to be part of this this group that's fighting. But let us say, for the sake of the argument, because you've touched on that and you've been honest and said you really know that they do support in one form or another the Muslim rebels. But let's say that what kind of a deal? What would the deal be? What can you imagine, and where would it lead us?
Basically, the Pakistanis, like you and I have spoken, I'm sure that the government would possibly not agree with my perspective, but I'm sure Pakistan provides aid, and if there is training that is taking place, Pakistan would actually even support that in whatever way it is possible, without actually formally having the Pakistan army become a member of the guerrilla groups, for example. So you do make sure that you do it. It's almost like when you are breaking any rules in the office, you make sure that you have enough excuses available to you to say that you did not really break the rules. However, what Pakistan does have is it has a great deal of influence on what the guerrillas do, for example, whether through its moral support, through its financial support, its military support, whatever you think it might be.
And so where can they go from here, Imran? I didn't mean to interrupt, but we're almost out of time. Where can they go from here then, in your mind, what kind of a deal might be struck?
What the deal the Pakistanis might be looking for would be that they would help the guerrillas withdraw so that the Indians can show that they have, you know, saved the day, etc. But in exchange, what Pakistan would be looking for would be United States support to say, yes, a United Nations resolution-based plebiscite will be held in the next 2, 3, or 5 years.
Well, Imran, thank you. Always a pleasure, of course. You have a great holiday, and you and I will talk very soon. Thank you again.
Thank you, and good evening.
That is Imran Anwar, founder of ImranNet Services in New York, pioneer of the Internet Mail in Pakistan, well-known media expert on India, Pakistan, and Southeast Asia.